So we are continuing our journey into Hilchot Deot, alias Hilchos Deos, Perek Hei Halacha Yud Aleph. And we started getting into the question, but we didn't really get to talk about it because we were running out of time. Perek Hei Halacha Yud Aleph, right. 5:11, right? As opposed to 9:11. And we didn't really get to talk about sort of the topic. And if you remember, what we said was that the Rambam was saying that a person, that there's a set order for things, right? That, you know, he quotes the pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Yudchet Halachi, pasuk Yudalin, that says that, you know, V'hi David Maskil, that the reason that so Rashi says Maskil, I pointed out to you, is Matzliach, that he's successful, but the Rambam says Maskil from the word Sechel, that David was thoughtful. You got to think things through. You don't just helter-skelter off into nothingness. So he says, obviously, the first thing you do is you got to get yourself a profession. And then when you get yourself a profession, then you get a place to stay. And then you get married. So obviously, life doesn't always make it so simple. And I mentioned last time that sometimes circumstances are different. But one of the sidebars that came up from that topic was the question of having a profession, right? And are you obligated to have a profession? It's clear that the Rambam, it's clear to me anyway, that the Rambam is not... He's not talking halacha. You're not over an isur halacha, right? You're not violating or transgressing or doing some prohibition by getting married without a profession. But the Rambam is basically saying you're just not being bright, and you have a responsibility to use the brain that Hashem gave you and to do things in a healthy manner. Clearly, the Rambam is saying that in the ideal world, a person has a profession. Now, here you're sitting in Israel, and I mentioned this last time, and you've got, you know, tens of thousands of guys who are sitting and learning, who've chosen, in order to learn Torah, not to have a profession. And the question is, what do you do with that? And I would posit, and I know this is a difficult thing to say, that that the Rambam would suggest that that's a big problem. In fact, if you look at the Gemara, all of the great Gedolim, I mean, there's famous stories about Hillel HaZakeh, who was found up on the skylight, you know, sort of trying to listen to the Torah through the snowy roof. What did he do for a living? He chopped wood. He chopped wood to earn enough money to live by. He didn't live on the dole. He wasn't a kolonik sitting and waiting for someone to pay him off, right? Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was one of the wealthiest merchants in the Middle East. And he had mansions, and he was a businessman, right? All the way down, by the way, to our modern day, the Torah Tmima. Torah Tmima was the son of the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan was probably... He was the Mishnah Berurah before there was a Mishnah Berurah. He was the greatest posek in all of Lithuania, which was including Vilna, right? 150 years ago. And his son became a businessman, but he wrote the Torah Tmima and he wrote the Baruch Shama, right? There's always a value to work. Now, one of the questions that you have then, which is a pretty obvious question, is, you know, tremendous Gedolei Torah, who say that a person can sit and learn in yeshiva, and maybe even a person should sit and learn in yeshiva. So, here's my theory on the topic, and then I thought we'd get into this discussion, because this is an important discussion, right? And it's unfortunate that in today's world, most people, they choose one side of the bar. They live in an extreme, right? Either they think that anybody who sits and learns Torah for more than, you know, a month or a year at best is ridiculous, right? And you have to go and do your university degree and earn a living or whatever. Or they think that anybody who goes to do a university degree is ridiculous because, you know, tzaddik b'emunato yechiyah, we should have emunah, we need to learn Torah, whatever. Is there a middle ground? And how could it be that such great Gedolei Torah supported the system? So I once heard a lecture from Rabbi Beryl Wein, which opened my eyes a little bit and caused me to do a little very non-empirical, non-scientific, unprofessional research, just on my own. How many yeshiva students, right? Today I mentioned that there are probably about 50, maybe even closer by now to 60,000 young men who are, I'm talking about, who are of the age that they could go to the army, they could be going to university, they could begin finding a profession. They're post the age of high school. 50 to 60,000 men that are sitting and learning Torah in Israel today, including you guys, right?
I thought the statistic only was people who are...
Israeli citizens, right. Yeah, that's true. You're right. Okay, so there are, by the way, from what I've heard, about 4,000 Americans who come every year to Israel to do this type of program. That's what I've heard. I don't know if that's an accurate figure, but that's what I've heard. Somebody at YU told me that. I said, is that just boys or is that boys and girls? No, that's boys and girls. There are about 2,500 girls and probably 1,500 to 1,600 guys. That's what he told me. Yeah, right. Isn't that interesting?
That's interesting.
Right? Girls are always more spiritual. There are always more women in the world. We used to run Israelite programs. You'd get like 8 guys and 22 girls, always. Never, you know, the girls, but the guys had it good. But anyway, so here's my theory on this, and I've heard different opinions on this. Oh, so Rabbi Berlwein, so he wrote this article, he gave this lecture. How many yeshiva students were learning in Europe before World War II? When I say learning, I mean, you know, they're 18, 19, 20, whatever, 17, 18, 19, 20, and they go off to yeshiva to spend 3, 4, 5, 6 years learning Torah, right? And they're in Radin, and they're in, well, Volozhin was closed already, and they're in Lublin, and they're in, you know, Panovich, and Satmar, and Belz, and all these different yeshivas, yeah?
5,000?
Pardon?
5,000?
Actually, about 3,200.
Oh, wow.
Right? That's it. In the heyday of Poland and Lithuania and all of Eastern Europe, there were maybe 3,500 yeshiva students tops. What was everybody else doing?
University.
They were working. No, they weren't going to university.
Wasn't also
there was. Although there was a movement towards universities by the early 1900s, and the Gedolei Torah and the Torah community felt that it was sucking the marrow out of Jewish living, you had the beginning from the time of Rav Shimshon Feil Hirsch in the 1860s, and I don't want this to be a history lesson, but that started to say that we can learn from science and we can embrace it, and it can be a vehicle to understanding the world of Torah. And you even had people like the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik, who went to, I think they went to the University of Heidelberg, but I might be wrong, or the Sorbonne. I think they went to the Sorbonne. And you did have that, but they went much later in life, and they already had their profession, which in their case was Rabbanus. But so how is it that today all of a sudden don't work, go sit in yeshiva? So I once heard sort of a perception that makes a lot of sense to me. I think that there was a sense after the Holocaust that things have gotten so bad and Torah is so decimated that it's almost like Eit Lasot Lashem Eferet Toratecha. We have to ignore the advice of Chazal because there's a greater need right now. Right? And so in order to ensure that Torah survives, in order to ensure that there are people learning Torah, right, then we have to pull out all the stops, create yeshivot, have people sitting and learning to bring Torah back to the Jewish people. And although they don't need my approbation, I happen to think that that was a good move back in 1948 or 49. And I think the fact that there were a few hundred boys sitting learning Torah was important, and it was important for the state of Israel. But I think now we've reached a stage where things have gotten out of hand. And the Rambam seems to say, well, obviously it's gotten out of hand, nobody's thought it through. I mean, just from a practical level. Now, I'm not talking about emunah. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants all these people to be supported, then they'll be supported. And if HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want them to be supported, then even if they go and get university degrees and get jobs and whatever, they won't be supported. But that's Hashem's job. Our job in the world of Ishtadlus, in the world of trying to, is to be maskil, is to be thoughtful, is to look ahead and to figure out what's the best plan, how does this work, right? In fact, I remember, you know, there are basically today four possibilities for a boy who turns 18. He can go to yeshiva, you know, Panovich, Amir, right? Sit and learn and dedicate 5, 10, 15, 20 years of his life to learning Torah. He can go to a Hesdi yeshiva where he'll find a balance. And very often, by the way, I mean, I was in yeshiva for a good 10 years. And there are lots of guys who stay in Hesdi yeshiva that long, but they all end up getting professions, getting jobs, and doing degrees while they're doing this, and whatever, kind of like the Neri Soil in Baltimore. By the way, I should point out, for reasons that are not quite clear to me, because I'm not a sociologist, and I'm not Bucky, and it's not really a pet issue of mine, I don't think that this problem is exacerbated quite the same way in America. Okay, in America, and again, I'm bothered by this term, but just for the purpose of this discussion, but the word Chared is a very difficult term. Chared means zealous. I think I'm Chared. I'm Chared about Halal and Yom HaTzmut, and I'm Chared about davening with tefillin, and I'm Chared about learning Torah, but okay, fine. For the purpose of the discussion, we understand what we're talking about. So the Haredi world in America, by and large, works. In the Haredi world in America, the proportions of people that are sitting and learning and not working more or less run similar to the lines that they were in Europe. You go to Lakewood, you go, pardon?
They got B&H.
What's B&H? Oh, photo, right. The photo stamp with 4,000. Right.
Because the state of Israel, if I'm not mistaken, gives them money and helps them out. In America, I doubt they receive any funds.
Right.
Like they have more of a,
right.
You know,
right. In America, you have to get people to donate, and here there's a system. Although here also it's not so simple, right? I think also that here it was born partly of a desire not to support the state, and specifically not to go to the army, right? For all sorts of various discussions and halachic issues, which I hope we're going to be able to get you, Rav Noam, to give a shiur on Yom HaTzimut, but I don't know yet, right? Pardon? Oh, so you have to fill me in. What?
A Declaration of Independence.
Ah, okay, that's good to hear. Okay, all right. So in America, you know, you have a lot of guys who they'll sit and learn in Israel, and they'll go do a degree in Johns Hopkins. They'll get a computer engineering degree. And that's why you'll find them working in business. So they won't get a degree, but they'll go to work, right? But in Israel, for whatever the reason, you have very, very large numbers of people that are not being supported, and they can't support themselves. And as much as the state offers them some compensation, it's not really enough for a guy to be able to support a family with 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 children. So what happens is these guys go on the dole. They have no money. And you know, that creates all sorts of social challenges, pressures, never mind the potential for Chilul Hashem. Now, that's, by the way, not at all to discount the tremendous value of the Torah that they're learning. I'm not the one to say that. I mean, some of you came with me when we went to Meir Shearim and visited the Mir. That's awesome to walk into a place and see that kind of Torah, especially after the Holocaust, right? But having said that, it's a problem, and it would seem to me that the Rambam is pretty clear on the topic, yeah.
Would you say those people who, let's say they are choosing to learn all day, but having 8 or 9, 10 children without any way to support them are being socially irresponsible, not just society, but their actual own children?
Well, see, now that, I don't go there. In other words, like, it's a reasonable question, you know. Is a person who's having 10, and by the way, 10 is an average number. I mean, I know more than a few fellows who have 17, 18, 19 children, you know. And the mother is going, and by the way, chas v'shalom, nobody in any way, shape, or form should in any way interpret anything I'm saying as deriding that. I mean, that's a tremendous thing. Chas v'shalom, there's no iser, there's no halachic issue there, whatever, right? And you could make a case. I mean, demographically, you know, the state of Israel gains from the fact that demographically there are more Jews in this country, right? So that's a difficult question. You could make a case for both ways, right? The halacha does not make this clear. In other words, there is an idea of Moshe as a famous psak that if a couple knows that they wouldn't get married because they just can't manage if they start having children, then he says that would be a halachic basis for certain types of birth control. I mentioned this the other day, right? That doesn't mean that you're obligated to employ birth control, right? And I get very wary of those types of questions because, look, the halacha is that midoraisa from the Torah, a person's obligated to try to have 2 children, a boy and a girl. And midrabanan, a person's obligated to try to have 2 boys and 2 girls. That's drabanan, right? Which means basically I'm done, right? So now at this point, once you've had 2 boys and 2 girls, kanai nahara, right? So now you get to think about it, right? And there, that opens up all sorts of halachic windows. So bemet, different people have different chishuvim. Some people, you know, choose not to have more children. Some people, for whatever the reasons, are unable to have more children. Some people choose to have professions and don't really think about it. And then all of a sudden they wake up and they realize they're 45 or 50 and they would have liked more children. Some people make a conscious decision. You know, it's a difficult question. If you have 4 children or 6 children, you know, like in my neighborhood, I'd say the average is like 5, 6, maybe 7 children, right? And a person can manage reasonably to have a close relationship with all 6 of his children and help them with their homework and support them, whatever. But on the other hand, when you have 12 children, so the older children are helping the younger children, I guess that's a difficult question. And I think each of us has to make that decision on our own. And that fits more into the category of, you know, we can judge an action, but you never judge another person. I get very nervous when people sort of look askance, like unless you've experienced what it is to be in a family. On the other hand, you know, I remember when we went to America for 3 years, and we would go to certain communities. Sometimes I would go on a scholar in residence. I remember I went to one community, and they were shocked, like they're wow, like I, you know, the topic comes up, you know, you married? Yeah, how many children you have? 4. I said, wow, that's a big family. And I remember at the beginning, I was like, I couldn't get my hands around that conversation. Like, how could somebody think that 4 children is a big family? Like in my neighborhood, we're like a small family, right? And it doesn't bother me, right? And then I started realizing in America, at least, not in Boca where we were, because that was a largely firm community, had lots of big families. But, you know, when I would go to, like, Phoenix or you know, certain areas in California, like Oakland, whatever, you would find that, like, most people have 1 or 2 children. And I have somebody very close to me who has 2 children. And, you know, he's very close to both his daughters, and, you know, so she. But the Shabbos table just seems a lot emptier. Like, there's something about having 6, 10, or 12 people around a table. And when you talk to people who have 7 or 8 kids, right? You know, I have a good friend who has 7 kids. And when the first one went away to yeshiva, they felt like this kind of like emptiness at the table, like there's only six kids now. And we were talking about this, and I remember thinking to myself, like, that's so wild. I can't imagine feeling only six kids. But then when Mayan, you know, sort of went to Midrashah, all of a sudden, like, I couldn't take for granted that there were six of us at the table, there were only five. So there's an energy that you bring into a family with that many kids if it's healthy. It just takes a lot more work. So that's not my issue. That's a legitimate question, but the question of parnasa, in other words, the responsibility to say, and this is what the Rambam's talking about, if you want to have a large family, and look, Hashem decides, you could work really hard, you could go out there and sell and do groceries and whatever else you're doing every day, and Hashem is lo matzliach yadecha, you know, okay, so then you could say, look, that's in Hashem's hands. But if a person isn't mishtadel, if a person isn't attempting, you know, then there has to be almost an assumption. There's an assumption that I'll bring these children in the world, and we'll get the community to support. That's a very difficult question. And that's what the Rambam's struggling with. Who says that you have the right to assume that the community is going to support you? Right? The Gemara says, you know, Alvai be'adam, a person should yaseh shabbato chol, or shabbatcha chol, make your Shabbos almost into chol, but don't become dependent on the community. Right? And that's what the Rambam seems to be saying here. Now, then there's the other end of the extreme. Then you get people who say, like, well, you know, you shouldn't be going to yeshiva. I sat with a pair of parents this year whose son really wanted to come to Israel. And they felt, you know what, he's finished high school, it's time to start life, he should go to college. And I'm having this discussion, I'm saying, like, if you tell me you can't afford to go to Israel for the year, that I understand. If you tell me, like, you don't want him to, like, what's the difference? Like, when he's 62, he's going to remember when he started when he was 18 or 19, like, that's ridiculous. And I realized that people were so stuck on the fact that this person had to get a university degree and you have to have a profession, and we know how these things work, and then he gets sucked in, and the next thing you know, 10 years later, he's wearing a hat or whatever. And I showed up, and I you know, somebody had given me the background. So I purposely went there like this. I took off, because in America I wear a suit, I took off my jacket and tie and sat down. I just wanted them to realize, like, that's not my space. So that's another extreme. Like, you meet people who can't even take a year to learn Torah. Pardon? Pardon? No, unfortunately. But maybe next year, right? We'll get him, right? But nah, I don't even want to see Shemra. But understand, watch you. No, just kidding. But understand. And by the way, you could make, like, where's that line? Like, if a guy tells me, I'll give you an example, and I don't say this now as a plug, I really say this because it's a good topic. Take, for example, staying in Israel for another 6 months or a year, right? So what we call Shana Bet, or Shana Half Bet, whatever it might be. If a person says to me, you know what, I got a lot out of this year, and I feel like I'm just not in that zone, and if I stay here for 6 months, I feel like I'm going to waste my time. I really feel I'm ready. I need to go back to college and get started. That's the bug that I have, whatever. I can respect that. Better to be in college accomplishing than to be here wasting your time. That I understand. But sometimes you meet a person who doesn't stay here because he feels like he just has to get started. Like, I did a year, but I got to get started. I got to get a profession. I'm going to want to get married. To me, and this is where the question comes, like, I don't know, where is the line? Is the line 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, right? To me, I meet lots of people who stay shunned, but I've never met anybody who's 40 years old who sort of regrets not having started college a half a year earlier, right? I do think you meet people who regret not starting college 5 years earlier, because then all of a sudden they get married, and now they have no degree, and they got to start working for their degree and finding partners. So that makes sense to me. But a year, 2 years doesn't make a difference, right? So that's an interesting question where that line is. But the principle that a person should attempt to find a way to support himself, because Hashem gave you talent and you can make a difference in the world, that very much is clear from the Rambam. Okay? Having said that, I understand where the Gedolim were coming from. The question is whether times have changed. And I would go you, by the way, one stage further. I think that, you ever read this, there's this like little book that they used to sell in like supermarket counters. It became like a bestseller. It's like a, you read it in like 40 minutes. It's called, Who Moved My Cheese? You know what I'm talking about? Right, anybody ever read that? No? It's basically about these two mice, and they're in this maze, and somebody keeps bringing them cheese. And so life is good, right? They're getting fat, they get the cheese. And one day, no cheese shows up. So they don't think about it, and then, you know, night falls, and there's no cheese. The next day comes, and they figure maybe there's a mistake, but now it's coming. And, you know, somebody's just been giving them cheese, and there's no cheese again. And this goes on for another day. And now they start to worry, what if the cheese is finished? So one of them says, okay, look, somebody moved the cheese. If we don't go out there and find more cheese, we're going to die. We're going to starve to death. And the other one says, listen, the person who brings us the cheese only knows that we're here. If we move, we'll lose the cheese coming tomorrow. Right? And so one of them ends up staying, and the other one ends up moving. Now, the one who ends up moving has a much more difficult time because he's got to navigate his way through a maze. Maybe he finds it, maybe he doesn't. But eventually he gets out of the maze and he finds a different room and there's more cheese and whatever it might be. And the first mouse dies because the first mouse didn't realize, if I'm getting it right, right? Or maybe we don't know what happens to him, but that's the assumption, I don't remember. Because the first mouse just didn't realize that somebody moved the cheese. You know, it's like, imagine that you work in a mortgage bank and you're selling mortgages and you're given low interest and whatever it might be, and you don't realize the financial bubble burst and you're still working in mortgages. And you don't realize, right? And you're excited because up until now, for the last 10 years, you know, you get some investors and you buy some real estate property, then you can turn it over. But somebody moved the cheese. You shouldn't be buying more real estate property in, 2008 because nobody's going to buy it, right? Sometimes your cheese moves and you don't realize it, right? I think that that can sometimes happen in a generation. I think the cheese is moving. I think what worked in 1965 and even made sense, and I do believe that the yeshivot that sprouted up in Torah that came back to Eretz Yisrael was a critical factor in the creation of this Medina, because a Medina without Torah would not be a Jewish state. But I think the cheese has moved. I think now there are many different systems. I mentioned before there are four options. So one option is Panovich and the Mir, and one option is the Hezdi Yeshiva, and one option is the Michinot, where a boy can learn for a year, year and a half, and then go into regular 3, 4, 5 years of army. And the fourth option is the person goes straight to the army. Today there's a very large and a very significant group of individuals who are not necessarily going to the Mir, but now that they're going straight to the army, and they're infusing the army with a much more Torah-invested sort of energy. And so therefore it's much easier today to be in the army and maintain a certain sense of religious identity and Jewish learning, whatever it might be, etc., etc. And I also think that the socioeconomics of the kollel system are falling into the ground. And some people just don't realize that the cheese has moved. You can't support 120 great-grandchildren and grandchildren. The welfare systems in America and Israel and everybody else are going kaput. And so pretty soon these people are going to find themselves without any support. So now is the time for people. And I think they're starting to realize that. That's why now you have a Nachal Haredi again. That's why you have Haredi units. That's why they're starting to allow women to study professions in some of the Haredi circles. Like, there's a movement. And I think that gradually this will change. But all of this stems from this Rambam. Yes.
Do you think if Ben Gurion declared when he made the state that all...
Hang on one second, I'm sorry. Are there windows open? Can we close these windows? These drums are just, like, out of control. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Ravi.
If Ben Gurion said that all these kids who want to be in yeshiva, young boys who want to be in yeshiva, if he made a rule that they had a law that they had to do chaz there, and not just be in yeshiva, they had to do chazdeh.
Or share with me. I don't understand why Haredim don't even do share with me.
Well, you have to understand.
You can't force it.
You have to understand. This actually relates to a leadership training topic, okay? There's a statement in Hebrew. It doesn't quite translate as well into English, which I once learned from a cab driver, but I discovered later that it's an Israeli saying, Al tiyet sodek, tiyet chacham. Don't be right. Be smart. In other words, I don't know, you're on your way to meet the CEO of Coca-Cola, and somebody bangs into your car, right? And he says, it's your fault, and you say it's his fault, but it's clear that he's on your side of the highway, right? So he's going to be wrong. So you're determined to be right. So you run home, and you get a camera to come back and film the cars, and you miss your meeting with the CEO of Coca-Cola. So you may be right, but you're an idiot, right? if you have a chance to, right, et cetera, et cetera, right? So I think to a certain extent it's the same thing. You have 50,000 people learning Torah together today. All that's going to happen if you pass a law that they have to go to the army is that you're going to have 50,000 people in jail. So instead of supporting them in... And what will they do? They'll demand the right to learn Torah. Right? One second. They'll demand the right to learn Torah. The rebbeim will come join them in jail. And all you'll have done is cause the state to support everything in the yeshiva instead of 70% of their budget. Because the yeshiva will be in the jails. Now, they might turn all the jail inmates into Bali Tshuva. That might be an interesting idea. But nobody wants that on their head. Plus, the political realities are that the fastest growing Jewish demographic is the Haredi community. So whereas, for example, when I got to Israel, Jerusalem was about, I think it was 8 or 9% religious. Today, Jerusalem is close to 30% religious. And that's why you had a Haredi mayor. And, secular Jews are leaving Jerusalem and Haredim are moving into it in droves. And, or up to a point, now that's changing economically. Right, so now it's changing, which is interesting. But, the economic reality is that 2 years ago, for the first time in Israeli modern history, the majority of children starting first grade in this country, Jewish children starting first grade, were wearing kippot on their heads. Now think about that. Think about that. 51% is one way of looking at a tipping point. Okay? Like, we're a democratic system, and therefore we make decisions based on majority. So if you get to a point where 51% have an opinion, that's going to be the opinion, right? Okay? So, well, it's scary or not scary, depending on how you look at it. But it, you know, is it 20 years? Is it 40 years? We're going to get to the point where the majority of the Jewish population of this country is religious and has a kippah on their heads. And when that happens, I don't know how much after that happens, because what percentage of them are Dati Lumi and, you know, national religious, but at a certain point, you're going to have a Knesset, which is a majority of people who are wearing kippot on their heads, or women, or whatever, that are religious, right? And that's going to change the whole vote system. The whole country is going to change. So I don't know that you could change that. But one of the things that does have to change, if you're going to run a state, is there has to be, you know, if the Torah supported this, then I would support it. But it just strikes me when you look at Makaros, and you look at the Halacha, and you look at the Rambam, you know, one of the answers you get, for example, going to the army. So one of the answers you get from people, you know, again, in 1952, I understand why some people didn't want to go to the army. It was very difficult to be religious in the army. I could hear it. It's a legitimate question. You can't really say that to me anymore. Today, the reason not to go to the army is twofold. One is because it's hard. And two is because your Rebbe says no, but if the Rebbe would say yes, they would all go. I don't think the army wants them, but that's a different issue. Right? Yeah, it's a different question. But, you know, at a certain point, something has to break. Like and you know, so one of the answers you sometimes get is, well, you know, the Levium didn't go to the army. So my answer to that is, well, who made you Shevet Levi? Like, who says you're Shevet Levi? Where does that come from? I've never gotten a good answer to that question. I've had this discussion at length. I used to sit on buses next to Haredim, only because I wanted to be sensitive, because if there's an empty seat and a woman would get on, you have all these terrible, uncomfortable stories. So whenever I would see a guy in a black hat and an empty seat next to him, I would sit next to him and figure I'm just going to save one machlokas for the Jewish people, right? And so inevitably, you know me, I'm like a schmoozer. So we'd get into discussion. He would always come back to this discussion. And I would always sort of ask these questions. And at the end, you know, it would always end up, well, I have to, you know, that's what my Rav says. That's a whole other discussion. Okay? So that brings us to Halacha Yud Bet.
Wait, weren't the Kamosach through one of the big Haredi rabbis for him to endorse something like Shirat Lomi or...
So that's starting to happen.
There have been some.
That's starting to happen. Little by little, it's starting to happen. You know? I mean, it's an unfortunate reality that there's a tremendous polarization. The Haredi world is quite legitimately and rightfully scared of the influence of Western society, the internet, etc., and therefore becoming more and more isolated. And I personally think that they're attempting to put off the inevitable. You know, you can't isolate yourself from the internet. It's like isolating yourself from oxygen. It's just there. You know, I told you my air conditioning box story, didn't I? No, I never told you the story? I don't know, I was like married 2 or 3 years, whatever it is, and we were moving. Like the first few years, we moved a lot from this cold apartment to that. So when you're moving and you're a young couple, right, so you do it yourself, so you're always looking for good boxes, right, to pack up your clothes, whatever. So I'm walking through down Ben Yehuda one day, at the bottom of Ben Yehuda, I see this big, like a, it looks like a TV box. And a TV box, if you have any knowledge of boxes, they're much thicker carton. It's like a good solid box. You could store things in it for a while. So I thought, this is a great box. I'll take this home, you know, in the car. So, it's theirs. It's Gezel, right? You know, I mean, not going down for a TV box. Like, you know, somebody left a suitcase with $1 million, that I could be struggling with. But a TV box, right? Gezel is Gezel, right? That, by the way, is a whole other discussion. How often we commit theft without even realizing. We'll get to that in Hilchos Deos, but in Vav. But anyway, so I walk into the store and I ask the guy, you know, can I have a, you know, there's a TV box out there, whatever. I need boxes. Would you mind if I take the TV box? He goes, no, go right ahead. He goes, I got a few more in the back. I said, really? He said, yeah. So I go to the back and I see that there's like 4 or 5 TV boxes. So I said, this is amazing. So, well, can I come tomorrow and I'll bring you? Yeah, sure. I said, why do you have so many empty TV boxes? He said it was very simple, because they come from Meir Sharim and they want to buy a TV. But they can't show their neighbors that they have a TV. So they said they'll buy a TV if I give it to them in an air conditioning box. So they take the TV, they put it in an air conditioner box. Then they go home, voila, I brought an air conditioner, but really it's a television. The Yetzer Hara will find its way in, whether it's in Mea Shearim or in Panovich or in Bnei Brak or Gush Etzion, right? That's the reality. It's still Yetzer Hara. So if you think that Yetzer Hara, you know, there are all sorts of post-game who talk about how you shouldn't go on the internet, only go on this type of internet, that type of internet. You know, maybe that worked when you had big home computers and a satellite dish to get cable so they could see it, so whatever. But today, when a guy can buy an iPod and put it in his pocket and watch TV and movies, I guarantee you half of the 16, 17-year-olds who can afford it, right? So it's only a matter of time. So once you're impacted by the internet, then you have to struggle with that. And that's a whole other discussion. And by the way, the Haredi world is starting to come to terms with the fact that they need to deal with this issue. They haven't, that they can no longer sort of just keep it out the door, and that they, therefore they have to struggle with how to deal with it from inside. Yeah.
But you're saying that it is the Yetzer Hara. So why is there anything wrong with them blocking off internet?
No. There's two separate issues here. One issue is, is the best solution just no internet, no TV, no laptop, no nothing? You could debate that topic very legitimately on both sides. That's one issue. And there are things you lose by cutting yourself from society, but there are definitely things you gain. But then there's a second issue, which is, I've said that there's no internet, and therefore there's no internet. And therefore you're denying the fact that you've got 15-year-olds who sit out at night and they're watching the internet. So in my community, they have all ways of dealing with it. Like, for example, I know a fellow who's a Frum guy. He used to do computers for us. And he's one of the licensed guys to sell internet remote, right? He told me an amazing thing. You know what internet remote is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you can't download all sorts of. Okay. You can't download all sorts of schmutz and whatever on internet remote. Okay. Pros, cons, whatever. Fine. Right. So he's a Frum guy. He's a stark guy, beard. You know the whole thing, and he wanted to sell internet remote in Bnei Brak, and people kept telling him there's no internet here, and he said to them, there is definitely internet here, and you know, the problem was in that neighborhood, you can't go in and sell unless you have a letter from a gadol. Like in my neighborhood, a guy comes to the door. Yeah, in my neighborhood, if a guy comes to the door and he wants to collect tzedakah, so Rav Riskin and Rav Perl, who's the Rav of Elon Shvut and now Rav Rimon, they all put out a letter that because beggars would come, and there were unfortunately sometimes people who were charlatans and whatever, and it created all sorts of challenges, that any person who wants to collect tzedakah in Efrat has to go to the Rabbanut and get an Ishur, and they check him out. And, you know, my wife actually, many, many years ago, my wife worked for an investment banker, and one of the things he asked her to do when we first married was that he was very wealthy, and people would come to ask him for tzedakah. He didn't have time to check them out. And he wanted to do chesed, but he didn't want to be giving money to some guy for his son's kidney when really the guy was going out and buying liquor. So she did. She did her due diligence. And she actually, there was a boy, a fellow who came, and he came to collect for his son who needed a kidney transplant. And so she found out, because there aren't that many organizations that help children, whatever, that this guy, it was known that he did in fact have a son who needed a kidney transplant, but he was taking all the money for himself. And they weren't living together, and his son was living with the wife and whatever. So she got on to him and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And a few years later, she was no longer working for him, and we were back in Efrat again, and he showed up at our door. And b'mikresh, she answered the door, and he didn't remember her. But she remembered him, right? So that's an interesting question. So it makes sense. You go to Bnei Brak, you want to collect tzedakah. Does the rav of the community say that you're legit? Only in that neighborhood, that's true for everything, right? My supermarket. If my supermarket doesn't have a letter that the rav says it's kosher, nobody will buy there, right? Right? But in some of the Haredi circles, they take it sort of a little further down the road. And if you want to be licensed, if you want to put, you know, bring a product in, the gedolim have to say it's okay, right? In some communities. So he couldn't get them to say it's okay. Why? Because there's no internet. And he said, there's definitely internet here. And if we don't sell this internet, Ramon, then people are going to be able to see all sorts of things you don't want them to see. And eventually, the gedolim put out a psak. It's usher to watch the internet. But, you know, it's like me telling anybody, it's usher to watch TV. You shouldn't watch TV today. Okay, but if a guy's machur, if he's addicted to television, then he's going to watch it. So that's the second issue. That's what I mean. Right? But it's clearly Yetzer Hara, and there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that if a person had to choose between having TV and internet and watching only TV and internet all the time, or having no TV, no internet, no laptop, and never watching it, he'd definitely be better off never watching it. The whole point of the Rambam is, can we find the middle path? Right? I mean, you know, I was preparing a shiur before Yom HaShoah, which I ended up giving you, and I Googled something and found something which is, you know, so you have to know how to use it, yeah.
Don't you think if Kol Judaism is basically, or one of the goals of Judaism is to recognize the oneness of the world, there's nothing better than the internet to achieve that goal?
Sure, I think that the internet, when the Zohar says that in the days before Mashiach, one of the things we're going to experience is Alma Diktanya, that the world has become small. And the Mefarshim aren't quite sure what that means. They have different opinions. Today we know exactly what that means. It's exactly what it means. I get on the internet and I can do a chat room and I can be talking with Jews in London and in Bolivia and Germany and we all be learning Torah together. It's amazing. It's absolutely the best vehicle for doing that. Although I think Twitter is probably going to take its place, but whatever, right? But it's also the best vehicle for children to watch porn. So how do you deal with those two realities? So you have to find the middle ground and know how to keep the Yetzer Hara away and allow the Yetzer Tov to do good things. That's all. The equation hasn't changed. It's just the variables that have changed. Understand? And I think it's much more challenging today. You know, a kid in 1899, if he wanted to do something like that, he had to go to a burlesque show and he had to find it. And it was, you know, much more difficult and dangerous than if he gets caught. Today, I read a statistical study that was talking about porn on the internet that says that some incredible number, that by the time kids in America graduate high school, something like 98.3% have watched porn at one time. 98, do you understand? We're raising an entire generation on pornography. Now, maybe I'm getting the number wrong. Maybe it was 93.8, but it was definitely in the 90s. That's amazing.
Is it such a bad thing? Is it such a terrible thing that, like, I know this is kind of a controversial question, but is it such a terrible thing that a kid sees porn as life, you know, and whatever he's at that stage, you know, that he's doing, you know, things that aren't good?
You have to understand.
He learns from it, like, he knows that it's wrong maybe later on, and you kind of maybe get to that.
Look, you have to understand, everything you do in the world, you pay a price for. And everybody has their, you know, if I had to choose between a person, let's say, watching porn every night or a person stealing, so the halacha talks about that. Like, porn is ben adam lamakom. Stealing is ben adam lachavera. And Hashem doesn't forgive you for ben adam lamakom until you're forgiven for ben adam lachavera. Like, that there are priorities. You'd be better off watching porn every day and not stealing, you know? I'm not saying that there aren't priorities. But understand, that everything you do in your life and every piece of your environment impacts you. You're in a car and you're listening to music and you're not even paying attention to the words. But sometimes the words on some of these songs are so horrendous, they're so vulgar, or they're so violent. Don't think that doesn't affect you. Doesn't it? And they've done studies on this. If you drive to work every day and you're listening to Vivaldi, or you're listening to, I don't know, a song that's, you know, joy to the world, you know, and all the peace and love and harmony, and we should love our neighbor. And the next guy over is listening and driving to the same job where he volunteers in a hospital. But he listens to music every day. It says, you know, kill them all, rape them all, I don't know, whatever else it says, right? So then he's going to get to work in a different frame of mind. And over a period of time, that will impact him. It will. Anyway, so that's the Rambam. I wanted to get through Halacha Yud Bet, but I see we're not going to manage that. So we'll finish Bezrat Hashem. We'll do Halacha Yud Bet and Yud Gimel. And hopefully we'll get to Perek Vav. It's not next week, the week after. Pardon?